So they sent nobody to Islamabad. But you know, these as you and I are speaking now, these messages are being exchanged between the Americans and the Pakistanis and the Iranians. And so who knows, maybe some last minute deal might be worked out. If it does, if it isn't worked out, you know, Trump's threat was that if the Iranians don't come to the table and sign a deal, that he's going to bomb them back into the Stone Age, that he's going to de destroy their energy infrastructure. And then the Iranians said, well, if you do that, we're going to destroy the whole region's energy infrastructure. And so it looks like there's a chance that war might restart and escalate.
Alex Craner, good evening to you, my friend. What's going on? How are you?
Thank you, Andy. Good to join you. Good afternoon to you.
Yeah, it's always really good to have you. So last time I had you on, it was really hard for us to make sense of the Iran war and everything that has transpired. Just we had a lot of questions. We had some assumptions, but what has things become more clear to you, or how? Yeah, where are you at? When? Why did this happen? And where are you at with all of this?
Well, you know, I can't really make sense out of it. It's you know, the consensus view that seems to be forming is that Trump went ahead and attacked Iran because the Zionist lobby dragged him into it. And for all I know, that may be true. I don't see what sense it makes because it was very clear since a very long time that any military campaign against Iran was unlikely to succeed. You know, Iran is a major power. It's a very large country with a very large population, with a very powerful military that has been preparing for this conflict for more than 20 years now. And they have, you know, it was known that one of the measures that they would do is close the Strait of Hormuz. And military advisors around Donald Trump were warning him that this might happen. Apparently, Trump himself decided that no, they're never going to do that. And so, of course, they did. And then, you know, it seems that the Israelis oversold their ability to mobilize assets on the ground in Iran and stage a color revolution and overthrow the regime. So the idea was, we'll mobilize people on the ground, we're going to bomb from the air, and we're going to topple the regime, and then we're going to bring a new regime, Shah Reza Pahlavi, you know, the son of the former king or whoever, and then, you know, we have the country. It's going to be ours to control. But none of that worked out, and so now it seems that Trump is in a position that is very difficult for him to get out of, especially because he can't admit defeat. He cannot say that he messed up. He has to declare victory. He has to, you know, because in the back of his mind are always the midterm elections in November, and so he's maneuvering furiously to somehow pull some kind of victory from this situation. And I think that in some ways he's making things worse because he got a ceasefire and he got negotiations. And that ceasefire could have been used as a foundation for some kind of a peace arrangement. And then, you know, Iranians opened the Strait of Hormuz. So he all got the Strait of Hormuz opened. So he almost got himself back to square one, almost. But then he decided to keep his blockade of the Persian Gulf intact and then seized an Iranian cargo ship. And so then the Iranians said, like, Well, okay, then we're shutting the Strait of Hormuz back again. So all that footwork was for nothing. And now I don't know what's going on. There's supposed to be a second round of negotiation in Islamabad. The Iranians will not talk to Kushner or Witkoff. So J.D. Vance was supposed to go, then he didn't go, then maybe he is going after all, or he's not going. I don't know that it's clear at this point what's going on, but the Iranians have basically said we see no point in negotiating at this stage, so they sent nobody to Islamabad. But you know, these as you and I are speaking now, these messages are being exchanged between the Americans and the Pakistanis and the Iranians. And so who knows, maybe some last minute deal might be worked out. If it does, if it isn't worked out, you know, Trump's threat was that if the Iranians don't come to the table and sign a deal, that he's going to bomb them back into the Stone Age, that he's going to de destroy their energy infrastructure. And then the Iranians said, well, if you do that, we're going to destroy the whole region's energy infrastructure. And so it looks like there's a chance that war might restart and escalate. And if that happens, we're all in very serious trouble.
Okay, so what's confusing to me is the blockade, the US blockade, because they wanted to open up the Strait of Hormuz, right? I mean, that just
Yeah,
seems.
yeah. Well, there's a perfectly straightforward explanation for that. Do you know, like, when you're in a relationship with a girl and you know that she might dump you and then you dump her first? It's like, no. Or, you know, like at work when they say like, no, you can't fire me, I quit.
Right.
You know, so I don't know what sense it makes. It seems to me that Trump has to create the impression that he's in control of the situation, which he is not. You know, I know that a lot of people think that he is, but if you look at the, you know, you can look it up online. You can look at the trajectory of ships sailing in and out of the Strait of Hormuz. And before the war, you can see that they all sail kind of right down the middle of the strait. Since the war started, you know, the Iranians have imposed that ships that sail through the Strait of Hormuz have to sail next to the Keshem Island. And then there's a little island that I forget what it was called, but they have to sail between them because that's, you know, that's Iran's checkpoint. And so now you see that virtually all of the traffic goes exactly there. So it shows you very clear visual who is in control of the Strait of Hormuz. And I guess Trump can take that. So he's like, no, I break out with you first. So I'm going to blockade the thing. But American blockade of the Persian Gulf is outside of the Strait of Hormuz. So the area is much wider. And this is not like a video game. This is difficult. You know, a lot of ships go by there. Now less than before, but let's say that before the war, it was anything between 120 and 150 ships a day. You know, policing this is not a simple matter. And you know, when they seized this Iranian cargo ship yesterday, it was like a 6-hour operation. So you're squandering resources, you're exhausting your troops to make a relatively silly point. And this ship was apparently sailing not from Iran to China, but from China to Iran, and the cargo on that ship was a Chinese cargo. And so now he's not only antagonizing the Iranians, he's also antagonizing the Chinese. Why? I can't explain, but I think that he's doing it to bring home the good news and to say like, ha, we we seize an Iranian cargo and we're going to keep it, and we're making money, and they're going to be begging us for a ceasefire. They're going to be begging us for opening the blockade. A blockade, a naval blockade, is an act of war. So it puts the Iranians perfectly in their right to shoot at American ships. So you're not just draining your people, you're putting it at risk of being struck. Casualties, injuries, destruction of material. To me, it doesn't make sense. And it doesn't seem that it makes any sense to anybody, because apparently it's also causing strife inside of the US command and control structure. People are not happy about this.
I know. I am assuming like the Tulsi Gabbards of the structure are not very happy about this. Talk to me. It's what's interesting to me is the whole China play and Europe play, because they were the ones, those are the two countries, continents that were so dependent on this oil. And that has obviously such a negative impact on their economies. And so China for sure is not very happy. Is this part of a stranglehold or like trying to box ch a China in potentially, you think?
It may well be, Andy. It's one of those gambits that it's hard to imagine what Trump is thinking, but it does seem to be the case, because among other things, I think just last year, China has completed a railway line between China and Iran. And this line has been one of the priority targets for the American and Israeli bombardments, and they have destroyed several tracks of this rail line, and I think as many as 8, 9, or 10 bridges. This is a big problem, because that rail line is part of China's Belt and Road Initiative, into which China has been investing hundreds of billions of dollars, and it's an important development initiative for long-term future of the region. So, destroying that it's not a very nice thing to do. Let's put it that way. And then also, on the 13th of April, so 9 days ago today, the United States signed a military cooperation agreement with Malaysia. And the reason why this doesn't look so good is because, Malaysia is the country that is adjacent to the Strait of Malacca, which is one of the main maritime choke points for China, the Chinese traffic to the West and back. So Middle East, Europe, Africa, and so forth. And so why would they sign this military cooperation agreement? It doesn't take a lot of imagination to guess that they probably want to have their cat's paw on Strait of Malacca, so that they can choke up Chinese commercial traffic through the straits there. And so, it's not an officially declared policy. Well, if we go back to the December 2025 national security policy, that was such a long time ago, I think people barely remember, but there was, China does feature important as a rival, as a but basically, the United States didn't declare war on China, but it seems that they're moving chess pieces in place to be able to suffocate Chinese economy, their development, and so forth. But I don't see that that can be successful, because again, the United States is overstretched. The American people don't want this. They didn't ask for this. They didn't vote for us for this. It's quite the opposite. They voted against this. Trump was, and then, an important part of the national security strategy was the United States focusing on their own hemisphere. And then if you go even more back in time, remember when Trump visited the Gulf Cooperation Council and he gave that wonderful speech that was really nice, and people were moved and they thought like, wow, finally a change in policy direction from the United States at last. Well, now it looks like we're straight back to George W. Bush policies.
It seems to me it's like the wild cards in all of this. Well, starting with was China and Europe, and I just go back to there's the why, and then it seems to me they're boxing Europe in, which I can understand. And again, I'm family in Europe, everybody, so I'm not for war with Europe or anything, but China was interesting. That was an interesting card. Again, just looking at the game, and I kind of see it, or I'm starting to see it, is like, but why they're suffocating China's economy, and why would you want to do that?
I don't know. The what makes all the sense in the world is for the United States to partner in China with China and to cooperate with China and with Russia and with Iran. These are all very, very wealthy nations. You can do big business with wealthy nations. You can sell them stuff, you can buy stuff from them, you can trade. It can be to everybody's mutual benefit. But I and then even if you remember in January of this year when Trump and his delegation came to Davos, well, they were talking about exactly this. They were talking about bringing back the American system of political economy, which means reindustrializing the nation. Which means, reindustrializing the nations means you're going to be producing stuff. If you're going to be producing stuff, you're going to be wanting to sell it to somebody. Wouldn't it be better to be partners with a wealthy nation that can absorb your output, that can buy stuff from you, that you have a ready large market with high purchasing power, that you have a good constructive relationship with. Because what Trump is doing now is the Tonya Harding approach to competition. And for people who are not old enough to know who Tonya Harding was,
The skater.
she was the skater, the contender for the American Olympic team in figure skating.
Boom.
And she kind of didn't feel like she was, Nancy Kerrigan was clearly a favorite. She was better, she was more talented, she was prettier and classier than Tonya Harding. So Tonya Harding had her boyfriend bash Nancy Kerrigan's knees, because then, like if Nancy Kerrigan can skate, then I'm the best, right? So
So that
I
seems
don't
what's
know,
going on.
maybe Trump wants to bash China's knees so that he's number one. I don't know.
It's impossible to predict, but it's like, where does this go from here? And it's wars, there's so many variables, it's so risky. And again, I'm not even talking about the ethics of it, but just it's so risky. And I
Yes,
think that's where we're at. It's just
exactly. Wars are
like,
incredibly risky. They're incredibly expensive. They're very easy to get into,
and they're
and
hard to
then
get
they
out.
take life of their own. You couldn't predict anything that happens next, and getting out of these wars is extremely hard. And this is why I thought that Trump would never attack Iran, because let's not forget, the United States just spent 20 years trying to tame the Taliban in Afghanistan. And then in 2021, they had to withdraw and turn the country over back to Taliban. And Iran is orders of magnitude more powerful than the Taliban. Like, what did you think? I truly cannot. This is why this idea that he was pushed into a corner by the Israel lobby, by Netanyahu, by the Zionists at home, because otherwise the story just doesn't make any sense at all. It's complete lunacy.
Next question, really, and this hits home for both of us, but especially for you. What is Europe going to do with all this when energy prices continue or to stay elevated, assuming that they stay elevated? I mean, Europe's going to be, was already in almost shambles. Now they're just going to be in shambles. Correct me if I'm wrong.
Well, I think that ultimately the European Union is going to disintegrate, but in the meantime, they already have their ideas, and I'm not talking about European people. I'm talking about the people in power in Paris, in Berlin, in London, in Brussels. They will probably try to take advantage of this crisis to impose lockdowns, to ration fuel, to ration energy, to ration food. Christine Lagarde of the ECB has already been talking about rationing food. And so it's maybe they get another hurrah at their new normal, where they say, like, well, no going back to new normal, to the old normal now. We're going to have to ration all these things. And guess what? In order to ration them, and to be fair, we need everybody's digital ID so that we know who got what. And voila, then you have like a dystopian Orwellian system. And so I think that they will try to do that. But all these leaders are extremely unpopular. Merz in Germany, Emmanuel Macron
France.
in Paris, and Keir Starmer in London, and Ursula von der Leyen in the EU Commission. They're all extremely unpopular. I mean, I could rattle off their approval ratings, but I don't even believe them, because I believe that I think that the lowest one is Emmanuel Macron with like 17 or 18% approval rating. I doubt that it's 17 or 18%, like unless they're polling his friends and relatives. I think it's lower than that still. I would say they must probably be very close to the approval ratings that Boris Yeltsin had in Russia in the mid 1990s, and he was polling between 2 and 6%. And I think, things are so dramatically bad in Europe that I'd be surprised if their real approval ratings are above single digits. And so, all of their whole agenda doesn't have any popular support. And so if it doesn't have popular support, how are you going to implement it? You're going to have to force everybody. You're going to have to work coercion and suppression and censorship. And that never works in the long term. You can intimidate people for a while, and we saw the pandemic, for a few months, a year or two at the max, people were kind of scared and intimidated and went along, but less and less every day, less and less every day. And at some point, the whole thing just dissipated. And I think that that's going to happen as well. And then the European Union is probably going to go the way of the Soviet Union. It's really a very, very similar political structure. And then I think the individual countries will each find their own way.
Talk to me a little bit about Russia and all of this. It seems like this actually is a benefit to them because China and Europe are forced to buy Russian oil, correct?
Yes, correct. But Russia has the other problem. Russia is still at war in Ukraine. And that war is not going particularly well because the new development are these drones. And so Ukrainians have been able to use the drones technology very effectively for medium range strikes inside of Russia. So they've been able to target Russian energy infrastructure and their facilities. Refineries, export terminals, storage facilities, and so forth. inflicting significant damage. And then, these FPV, first person view drones, they have proven extremely effective in killing infantry, which is now the main reason why the front lines haven't moved a whole lot in the last few months, because the Russians cannot move infantry forward without them getting slaughtered by the Ukrainian drones. And well, the Russians are going to have to resolve this problem, and I think an ominous sign of how they intend to the one of the options that they have in solving this problem is that they plan they have published a list of European companies that are building these drones for the Ukrainians, and they're a little bit all over the place, but the Russians have their accurate addresses, actual physical addresses in the world where these facilities are located. And so that's a big warning. And I think at some point, we're not there yet, but at some point they might actually launch strikes into Europe to destroy these facilities.
So if that were to happen, and we're not there yet, and God forbid for that to happen, Europe's got to respond. And then you have a war with the EU or Europe and Russia. And I don't see really how Europe, without the help of America, which I don't think they have, is going to hold up at all.
Well, if you think that, then you don't know about our shared values, I think, maybe.
Right? A bit of
Yeah,
comedy.
you're right. I don't see that either. But Russia doesn't want to go to war against Europe. But Europe is more and more openly and more brazenly supporting Ukraine in their proxy war against Russia. And Russia has been struck several times with British Storm Shadow missiles. And Ukrainians can't operate Storm Shadow missiles
Think about
without
that.
British specialists supporting them. And these British specialists and the Storm Shadow missiles couldn't materialize in Ukraine without the explicit approval and that decision being made by the highest levels of British government, which means that Britain is at war with Russia. And so Russians obviously don't want to hand the Europeans the gift of that escalation, but they would be in their right to strike at Great Britain and France and Germany, because, okay, so Germans haven't given the Taurus missiles to the Ukrainians, but they provide other types of support still, and anyway, I think we have Vladimir Putin's restraint to thank that we're not in a bigger war than we are. But at the same time, there's a lot of people in Russia who are thinking like, what's going on? Are we going to take care of this, or are we just going to watch as they strike at our country and this war drags on forever? So, political pressures are growing on him to do something a bit more drastic.
So it seems to me in all of this, and I'm not by any means advocating for this, and there's no winners, but it seems like to me if there is a winner, and I use that with the air quotes, it's really the US because we're isolated enough, and then everybody's going to want our oil. Right?
Well, yeah, but
And that's not an advocating. I'm just trying to.
I know, I understand, but in a way, I don't understand the logic of this either, because, okay, so the American oil majors are going to be exporting a lot of oil and selling it at high prices, but the American people and businesses are going to be paying a lot more expensive oil all the same. It's not like everybody benefits, it's just like a small vested interest benefit. So you wouldn't want to run a geopolitical strategy just to benefit a number of corporations. because you're gonna end up alienate and antagonize everybody else in society, which is what's actually
Which what's
happening. I
happening.
mean, yeah, and so that doesn't make sense either. And then also, the United States imports, United States exports oil, but it also imports oil because it has certain grades, but it needs other grades for diesel, for jet fuel, and so forth. That doesn't strike me like a valid reason for war. These are all issues, imbalances that can be resolved much more easily, much more cheaply around the table. You say, we need this. How can we get it from you? What can we give you in return? Deal, sign the paper, and that's how everybody else in the world gets everything they have, Not everybody has military bases everywhere around the world. It's not necessary. The war is not necessary. The only people in society that need war for their business are the bankers, because only the bankers get to issue loans against collateral, which has to be conquered by force, or you have to take political control of these colonies, right? So either you have to conquer them militarily, or you have to regime change them, you have to stage a color revolution or whatever, but you have to take political control. Nobody else needs polit You and I don't need to take political control of Iran or Saudi Arabia in order for there to be gas at the gas pump. It's going to be there anyway. There's gas at the gas pumps in Switzerland. Switzerland doesn't go to war against to conquer or regime change another country. It's just done by trade, and everybody can do it that way. The only people who don't make anything if it's done that way are the bankers, and they require political control of countries.
So that gets to it. Is this all coming from the bankers then, in your opinion?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. There's no doubt about it. Well, it's quite simple. If you take political control of a country, let's say like Iran, which is the fifth richest country in the world in terms of natural resources, an estimated wealth of resources of at around $30 trillion. And so if you take control of its government, then you can make sure that all the best contracts, like the cream of the crop, is given to Western corporations who are clients of City of London and Wall Street banks. And then those $30 trillion of resources are going to be collateral that are going to back up these loans in case the client can't pay it back. But the minute you issue, if you're the banker, the minute you issue a loan to your client, that loan automatically becomes an asset on your balance sheet, and it's a performing asset because the client has to return it with interest. So just like that, other people's wealth become part of your balance sheet, and the result is that you have this conveyor belt of real wealth accruing to your bank, to your institutions. So that's primarily Wall Street and the City of London. And so, and if you take, because what we see, what's visible to us on the ground, is you see these Halliburtons and KBRs and Royal Dutch Shells and ExxonMobils and so forth, who go and do their heavy lifting and their dirty business in other countries. But this is not inevitably their incentive. As far as the corporations are concerned, they could just as easily buy this oil from the Saudis, from the Russians, from the Iranians, bring the tanker to their own market, put on their margin, and have a fantastically lucrative business on that basis. They wouldn't have to go into the country, develop their resources, and then fund the development from, Goldman Sachs or JP Morgan. They wouldn't have to do that. And then also, as far as corporation is concerned, if they need a $1 billion loan, it doesn't matter whether it comes from a Wall Street bank, or from a Russian bank, or from a Chinese bank, or from an Iranian bank. They don't care. $1 billion is $1 billion. It's only the banks that deeply care. And so that's why they have to buy the whole political class. They have to buy the media so that you can demonize, Gaddafi and Saddam and Bashar al-Assad and Slobodan Milosevic and Hugo Chavez and so forth. And then you can sell the people the story about how evil these people are, and we have to kill them because they're killing their own people, or they're madmen, or they're dictators, or whatever. But that's, that's the story that's been going on in perpetuity practically my whole life. I've been
Mine
watching,
too.
it was Slobodan Milosevic, and then this was that guy and this guy, and they're always evil, they're super evil, and we're always going to war for all the right reasons. But the wars never stop. And it's just like one story after another. You can go back to the 70s, Salvador Allende in Chile. He wasn't a terrorist, but he was a communist, right? Good enough, take him down as well. And this is why it's going on. It's not because anybody cares. Ordinary people don't care. They don't even know where any of this is, who these people are. Are they evil? Are they not evil? Even if they were evil, wouldn't it be right to say, well, if the Iranian regime is so horrible and oppressive, shouldn't it be up to the Iranian people to deal with them in their
Right.
good time? Why do we have to go to war there? Why do we have to send kids to get blown up and wage war there, have a $1 trillion military budget, have 800 military bases everywhere around the world? Why? To suppress evil? Says who? It's just narratives, it's stories that they tell us because the bankers control the media, and they control the big tech, and they control our politicians, and they control the military industrial complex, and so on and so forth. So that's why we have this dystopian state of permanent warfare.
Yeah. Do you think this is not the state of warfare? I think that's going to go on as long as the system is around. But do you see any specifically to the Strait of Hormuz and Iran? Do you see a resolution happening anytime soon or even by the summer? Or do you think this gets sorted out?
No, I don't think so, Andy. I mean, maybe they solve it for time being, but they will. The centers of power in the West will never give up on trying to regime change Russia, on trying to regime change Iran, and ultimately, China is going to find itself on that list. And the reason is exactly this, because their whole fraudulent monetary system requires to constantly grow. And as you saturate an economy with debt, there's no more money good collateral in it, and so you have to take collateral elsewhere. So you end up colonizing other countries. And that process never stops until the empire actually collapses. So it's not going to stop until the empire collapses or until they're victorious. But that kind of never happened. All the empires eventually collapse because they get overstretched. They can't fight all the wars that they would need to fight to suppress all the resistance, because colonization always triggers a resistance movement, and so you always have to suppress it, which means you always have to mobilize armies, which is always incredibly expensive, and the cost of running the empire to the society from which the empire rises is always much, much larger than the benefit of the empire that accrues to a very small set of vested interests. So it never really works. And this is why empires have also always migrated, because when you deplete one host, you move. So, they started in Venice. They practically destroyed Venice. Then they moved to Amsterdam, to Holland. Then when they depleted Holland, they moved to England. We get the British Empire. And then when they depleted Britain, then
You
they
go to
moved to the
DC.
United States.
Yeah.
But is United States in the zenith of its power? It's definitely very clearly past that zenith, and we've seen it in Afghanistan, we've seen it in Yemen. The United States can no longer win wars.
Yeah.
It's starting all these wars, but it doesn't win a single one.
Right.
And it's
That's since
always a
World War
cost.
II.
It's, yeah, exactly. So I think that it's not going to be over very soon because they will never give up, but at the same time it is going to be over because ultimately it's going to lead to a collapse.
Yeah. God help us all, man. That's all I have to
No,
say.
I think it's good news for the rest of humanity, you know,
Yeah,
because
I would agree.
we're all kind of caught in this, and
Yep.
the transition will be a great challenge for everybody, you know, because it'll affect us all. But I think that on the other side of that story, we have a chance to build a different society from a blank slate. Well, not entirely, but you know, at least all these obsolete structures are going to collapse, and we have a chance to build something new in their place. I think in order to do that, we need to have a lot more conversations like this, and we need to pay attention to what's going on, how the world really works, how the society works, how the economy works, what is the meaning of money and credit and circulation. And then we have to design a new system to make sure that it actually serves humanity rather than this these you know Epstein class monsters that are at the levers of power today.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more with you. Speaking of which, I'm looking forward to that conversation continuing with you in person in Atlanta. I'm really looking forward to seeing you, and some of your other friends will be there. And yeah, it should be a great time, but also just really good discussion. So,
I look forward to it, and I want to thank you for buying me that first class ticket to Atlanta.
no problem, no problem. My kids say you're welcome. No, I'm teasing. Alex, if people want to read more about you, how do they do that? How do they find you? How do they reach out to you? Give me your Substack.
Yeah, so they can find me on X. My handle is at Naked Hedgie. I have two Substack publications. One of them is a daily trend following newsletter covering 18 global markets. It's called iSystem Trend Following. I also have a personalized Substack publication called Alex Craner Substack. And as of this year, I also restarted my YouTube channel, which I think is called Alex Craner. There's a few AI
There is. There
fake
is.
channels,
Yeah.
but mine is called just flat out Alex Craner, and it's not AI, even though a lot of people ask me, is this AI? Because you know what I do is I make my reports, I script them, and then I read them off the teleprompter, so I barely move. I'm very static, and then people say like, oh, this is AI slop. It's not. It's just shot that way.
Yeah.
But
Well, you can tell what I could tell because I saw you, then it was like Dave Ramsey's voice, or is it different voice?
right, yeah. And also AI pronounces English better than I do, because I still make a lot of mistakes. AI doesn't really.
Yeah.
So that's how you can tell.
Well, I'll put all the links in the show notes, both on YouTube, Apple, and Spotify. Alex, really looking forward to seeing you. As always, it's just a great. I don't want to say it's a great time. It's great
It's
information.
interesting time,
It's
yeah.
very interesting. Yeah. I want to thank you so much for, again,
Excellent,
look.
Andy.
Yep.
Good to join us today. Thank you for the invite, and until the next time, until a few days from now in Atlanta.
Yeah, I look forward to it. Take care, my friend.
Take care. Bye-bye.